Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini, and today I have a very special guest with me, Greg Davies of the Blendover podcast. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing well. Dilligaff to all of you out there in the internet.
For those listeners of ours who are not familiar with your show, tell us a little bit about the Blendover podcast.
Well, the Blendover podcast is basically the tagline we use is that we bring you the news that the news isn't covering. When people do podcasts, like as in the Drill Down, we're looking at your show notes on our back end here. You make a list of things that you want to talk about that's pretty important and big in the world of tech. Well, with Blendover, what we do is we make a list of stuff that we're not going to talk about, and that's basically the stuff that's trending, the stuff that's being rammed down people's throats in television news and mainstream media and on the web as well. And so what we try to do is we try to seek out other stories that we think are just as important that are not getting enough coverage. And that runs the gamut from news, politics, world news, all the way through to entertainment, movies, tech, music, and so on and so forth. And we have a ball doing it. It's really good. It's fun getting in there and digging up stories that people may not have been privy to through the week. And one of the other things that we often run into is that our listeners will actually reach out to us and say, hey, we found this story and it's not getting any coverage anywhere. Would you guys be interested in putting it on the show? And usually it's something that's right up Blendover's alley. So, you know, that's what we do. That's what the show's about. And we have a ball doing it.
I think it's terrific. I've guested on the Blendover podcast many times, and it's always a challenge for me to come up with a story that isn't trending in the media. I have to really sort of stretch my muscles and find something that is not on your no-go list, no-go zone list.
You know what I do find, though, when you're on the show with me, though, Andy, and you have a bit of a talent for this, is that a lot of the stuff that you bring to the table on the Blendover show is usually not necessarily stuff that's not being covered in the mainstream media, but stuff that is about to explode in the mainstream media, meaning we're doing the coverage on it first before anyone else. And that is a pattern that does happen regularly on the show as well. We usually bring things to the table before they become huge explosions. One of the most recent examples of that was the botched execution here in Oklahoma City. You may have heard about that when that was making the rounds.
Sure.
And it actually stems to a much deeper, more disturbing issue about the black market on lethal injection chemicals and things like that running through the United States at the moment. And the night we did that podcast, we predicted that it was going to be a botched execution. And the next day, it was like we were Nostradamus. We were right on the money.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty scary.
Yeah. It does happen on occasion, especially when you've got so many data points. Like, you do your show twice a week.
Yeah.
So you have that many data points that you can get a real sort of sense of the trend in news and what is about to explode and what, you know, you do have and that uncanny sort of predictability, prediction factor where you can predict.
We also have, I think, you know, when you do a show like Blendover and you're trying to avoid the trending topics, you get not only a feel for what is going to trend, but also a feel for how media works.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And how they gravitate towards certain situations. I mean, case in point was the terrible killings that happened over in your state just in the last week on Friday night in Isla Vista. And, you know, there were several other, you know, killings across the United States in that previous week that never got as much coverage as what this kid did. Of course, there's other extenuating circumstances with his, but you can kind of feel which topics are going to be the most appealing for the television news channels. And how they work, which is sadly very disgusting, but you get that.
In any case, a big fan of the show, obviously, and I'm glad that you're doing it.
Well, can I just say while we're on the plug spiel at the moment, for anybody listening to the show, if you're interested in checking out Blendover, we'd love you to check it out. We also do it live as well. We broadcast live Monday nights and Friday nights, 8:30 p.m. Central Time. So, if you got a Monday night or a Friday night free and you don't really download podcasts very often, you can tune in and have a listen to it while we're mm-hmm. actually recording the show. So, you know, it's a lot of fun. Blendover.com is where we're at, and the live show's at blendover.com/live.
Excellent. This week on The Drill Down, Apple sings to the tune of Beats, Amazon's war with publishers hits the consumer, Skype unveils a universal translator, Google designs its own self-driving cars, and much, much more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com and leaving us a review. Our subscription links are in our show notes. If you do that, please leave us a review. Tell us how we're doing. We'd love to hear from you. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. And write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Let's just jump right into headlines. Mm. So this week, we talked last week about the potential purchase of Beats by Apple. And this week, Apple confirmed that it was, in fact, buying Beats Electronics for $3 billion, which will help it play catch-up with the rivals that offer subscription-based music services. Apple and Beats executives on Wednesday said that the companies would work together to give consumers worldwide more options to listen to music. The Beats brand is going to remain separate from Apple, and Apple will offer both Beats streaming music service and the headphones. Tim Cook said in a quote at Code Conference, "What Beats brings to Apple are guys with very rare skills. People like this aren't born every day. They're very rare. They get music deeply, so we get an infusion of Apple of some great talent," referring to the acqui-hire of Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, who are on the board of Beats. Founders of Beats as well. "We get a subscription music service," he said, "that we believe is the first subscription service that really got it right. They had the insight early on to know how important human curation is." So we talked about this on the show previously, what our speculation was, why Apple was buying Beats. And as we had speculated, it wasn't for the headphones, or it wasn't primarily for the headphones, but it was for the Beats music streaming service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about this on the Blendover podcast as well. Actually, mm-hmm. you were on the show and you brought it up, and that was when it hadn't been officially confirmed. But I mean, this is massive news today—the official confirmation that Apple are basically buying the company. And one of the things that I had spoken about with regards to this particular issue was if Apple wanted to be on a winner with this, what they needed to do was take a leaf out of the Disney model and just buy them, but not change them. Let them keep their imagery, let them keep their branding.
Yeah.
Much the same way that Disney did with Marvel, the same thing way that they're doing with Lucasfilm. You know, it's a winning strategy. You'd be crazy if you wanted to change the brand on it. But what I want to know, what I think is probably the most important here, is what kind of doctorate does Dre have? I've always wondered this.
I believe he's. It's a. I think he's a doctor of medicine. I think he has a medical.
Are you for real? Is that for real?
I think he has a license in brain surgery, I believe.
Oh, okay. You sure it's not a marijuana dispensary or anything like that? No. Okay. I'm just messing with you all. But you know, he what a journey that guy's had. Really, when you think about it, from where he came from, NWA, into the rap world, and you know, jumping into tech industry like this. I mean, really, what Dre did with Beats headphones mm-hmm. was a very, very successful brand, and that's why it sells. I mean, there's a dozen other type of headphones that are as good quality or better than Beats, but they don't sell as much as Beats. And a lot of that could be credited to that company's exceptional branding, which is something that I think Apple can Apple have actually done in the past. In a way, you could say Beats is emulating Apple in that regard, in terms of marketing and branding. But this is a big deal. I think it's fantastic. It's a great deal for Apple, especially with the streaming music service, something that they've been desperate to get their hands on for some time. I mean, their previous attempts at it have been utter shit. They've been really bad. I mean, let's be honest about it. iTunes Radio was horrible. It was a horrible product.
Yeah. Nobody used it.
Yeah.
Really?
So, but this is a good way to actually get it all on board, you know, in the new OS. And, you know, with any luck, I mean, we'll see, you know, the Beat stuff start showing up on iOS, you know, in the very near future.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, curious that in the official press release, Tim Cook made a statement, Jimmy Iovine made a statement, but curiously, Dr. Dre did not get a statement on this event. So I don't know why he was excluded from...
maybe all he said was word.
Word.
I can't think of anyone who would criticize this. I mean, this is a boom for Apple.
It's a win-win for both companies, really, because Beats gets the massive power of Apple powering them, and Apple, of course, gets the name cachet of Dr. Dre and Beats, plus the already successful. We talked about on your show, Greg. We talked about one of the reasons that we think that Apple was attracted to Beats was because their conversion rate from free users to subscribers was impressive.
Mm. Now, what's going to be very interesting about this is to see what happens with their numbers over the next year or so. That's going to be fascinating, because what I found, Andy, with you know, the difference between music streaming services and movie streaming services is that is a loyalty issue. Like, when it comes to movie streaming, everybody uses Netflix. Everybody uses Netflix. Sure. Who doesn't? I mean, but there's others that also use, in addition to Netflix, your Amazon Prime, your Hulu Plus, and your other services that are out there. But with music streaming services, what I've found on the user end is that people are fiercely attached and loyal to their chosen streaming type. Like, if you talk to a Spotify user, they love Spotify. Yeah. If you talk to a Pandora user, they love it. I'm a Google Music user, and I love the premium service that they have. So the conversion rate after the Apple acquisition and the numbers, that's going to be interesting over the next 12 months. So 12 months from now, at the end of May 2015, it's going to be interesting to see where Beats stands as a streaming music service.
Yeah. I can't wait to see how that pans out for them, and we will. We'll be seeing that moving forward.
That's right, folks. You can count on the Drill Down to follow this stuff. That's what Andy does on this show, the Drill Down, where they follow this stuff all the time.
Yep.
So tune in more often, and you'll be on top of the tech news, I'm telling you.
And speaking of following up on tech news, last week we talked about Chinese nationals hacking the U.S. and how the U.S. was formally charging them with cyber spying. And now it turns out news is that three U.S. Companies identified as Chinese hacking victims didn't report the theft of trade secrets and other data to their investors, despite rules designed to disclose significant events. And two of the makers, Alcoa, which is an aluminum maker, and
big industry.
Yes, big industry. And metal supplier Allegheny Technologies said that the thefts weren't material to their business and therefore don't have to be disclosed. But, you know, this is an issue in light of last year's hacking of Target. That massive hack of Target's consumer base, their credit card.
Point of sale.
When do you tell people when you've been hacked, especially in instance like this, where this is an international case of cyber spying?
Well, it depends what your definition of hacked is, Andy. I mean, you know, does it mean that, you know, do you have to report every incident of someone, like, you know, butting in on your ports? I mean, I don't think that would be necessary. But when you have significant theft of data, sensitive data in particular, I mean, that would be, I think that would be grounds for some kind of public disclosure. It would be, I think that's a good practice. I think it works across the board, not just in big business. And I mean, it works across government, it works across education, higher education. And, you know, it's important, I think, to be aware that, you know, that this is something that needs to be done. But there's something about the concept of hacking and data theft in society. Like, there's almost a taboo feeling among people who aren't necessarily tech savvy, shall we say. Like, it's almost like if your data gets violated, you're shamed, or you should be ashamed of it. It should be, you don't want to talk about it. Yeah. But I think you should. I think it's good security to it's a good security practice, because not only are you letting your investors know, and by investors I don't just mean financial investors, I mean people that might be invested in your industry personally, that you inform them that there's some kind of disclosure practice there. I think that's very important. It also gives people, it gives security experts a better gauge of how widespread a specific problem is. Like, we really haven't been given a lot of information about these so-called Chinese hacks in terms of how they got in and compromised these systems. Yeah. And usually when there's some kind of vulnerability or workaround or something like that, or a zero-day threat, usually you see the security industry all over that stuff. But you're not seeing it with this. It's rather strange. So, you know, I think there needs to be a little bit more disclosure here. But, I mean, really, I think what does the government really have to disclose on this? I mean, I don't see any – I really don't see any relevance in this particular indictment that's been put out by Eric Holder. It's a joke. What are they expecting, you know, these – Chinese hackers to be, rendition to the United States? I mean, it's not going to happen.
Well, you know, we discussed this on the last week's episode of the Drill Down. We feel it's a symbolic statement. I mean, it's basically the U.S. government's way of saying there need to be consequences for these sorts of actions, and somebody needs to be made an example.
Yeah, but how are they going to make an example of them? That's the thing. Like, it just seems to me this is just press time for Eric Holder. You know, that's all I see.
Could very well be.
You know, and it really, I mean, it does nothing to inform the public of how they can be better secured in their computer, in their computer technology, or in how industry can be better protected. It doesn't do anything. All it does is it just paints a big black mark over China in the media,
I think that's partly the point.
Yeah, this is political. Yeah. It's absolutely got nothing to do with tech.
Absolutely, it's political.
But that being said, there's no reason why us techies can't use this as yet another example as to why we keep harping on to, you know, all of the industries that we collectively work for, mm-hmm. that security should be number one in terms of tech. It's incredibly important. And a lot of people really don't understand how significant it is, particularly until they get hit, you know, and there's some kind of theft of data.
Sure, sure. Mm. I think it's a good wake-up call for tighter security in general and major corporations, international corporations.
Yeah, absolutely. Alcoa, though, that's a huge hit.
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh, you know, they're a massive industry. And, Andy, where I'm from, actually, Alcoa have a big industry in Western Australia. There's a lot of bauxite processing that happens in Perth, Australia. And I actually have a relative of mine that works for them. And they've got such a good reputation in Australia. They're quite a renowned company in Australia, and you know, this is just going to just tarnish their reputation. Probably not irreparably, but for a while it will. See, just public disclosure is a good thing.
Get out in front of the news. Don't.
Yeah, exactly. And just say, hey, we're working on it, and we're improving security. And this is what we're going to do for the people affected.
Speaking of international lawsuits.
Yeah. I think the whole thing about the U.S. trying to indict Chinese hackers has about as much effectiveness as the news that came out of Iran just this last week. Mm-hmm. Basically, a report came out of Iran the other day that a local judge had ordered Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg to appear in court locally in Iran to answer complaints by individuals who say Facebook-owned applications, Instagram, and WhatsApp violate their privacy. Uh-huh. Some reasonable claims here. I mean, there's a lot of people that have concerns about privacy with Facebook and their relative products. I would agree. But, you know, when the news came out, people just were jumping up and down about how big of a deal this was. I think it just came out this morning. And, you know, the first thing I thought of when I saw this was like, oh, it's not going to happen. You know, there's no way in the world. I mean, this is just the Chinese hackers all over again, but in reverse.
Right.
You know, it's just they're not going to get him over there. There's no way in the world.
Yeah.
Anyway, as it turns out, I mean, a chief prosecutor in Iran, Ali Al-Ghasemir,
mm-hmm.
is quoted by the official IRNA news agency as saying that Zuckerberg has not been summoned to court. And so basically the whole thing is just misinformation or a hoax. So, you know, this works both ways. Yeah. I mean, the whole argument about Chinese hackers, I mean, China hacking U.S. industries.
Yep.
Nobody talks about how many industries and governments overseas that we hack. NSA, anyone? Hello?
Yeah.
So, but while we're on the Facebook kick, Andy, there was a story that grabbed my attention this week that I felt like bringing up on the drill down.
Absolutely.
There was an article that came out over at the Raw Story just in the last week entitled, "Here's How Facebook Can Now Listen to Your Private Conversations." So, you know, you can already tell by the headline that it's got a little bit of crack pottery in there.
Yeah, it's a little sensational.
Yeah, I like a little bit of crack pottery in my diet. So, you know, I couldn't help but read it. But basically, they're issuing a new tool in their app, which has, for some people, it's already been deployed, others it has not. But basically, they announced a forthcoming app update in which a new feature uses the phone's microphone mm-hmm. to capture sounds in the user's environment, and then it identifies the song, the movie, or the television show the user is watching based on what it hears. Once the sound is ID'd, the users have the option to share it as a visual component of their posts.
Shazam uses a very similar technology.
Yeah, I mean, this comes down to, tech competition, but it also comes down to getting an edge in marketing.
Yeah.
Because if you can make a Facebook post that says, chilling with my homies, drinking gin and juice,
sure.
You know, sitting on my couch... and it captures like the sound of, you watching The Simpsons or hears Homer Simpson's voice and identifies that noise as associated with The Simpsons. It can auto tag that you're watching The Simpsons at that very moment along with your status update. And to the uninitiated, that might sound like a really cool little feature that you can use. But essentially, at the end of the day, what it's just going to do is it's going to generate more data for Facebook to sell to marketers to target you with.
Of course.
So if you're watching The Simpsons while you're making that post, you can imagine you're going to get all kinds of ads on your feed about The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Or related topics. You're going to get that. Or you're going to get suggestions about it. It's all big data and targeting and stuff like that. However, this is the part where the Raw Story is a little concerned about it, and they started to go into the crack pottery argument. And the paragraph reads, though Facebook assured that no sound is stored, the company acknowledged to International Business Times that it does intend to archive the data gleaned. So there's a little bit of worry over there as to what they're going to actually do with the data. My initial suspicion would be is that it's for marketing purposes. But we all know about PRISM. We all know about the arrangements that the NSA has with a lot of these tech giants. There's no reason why they can't use this data as additional data. And of course, as we know, as we've talked about on this particular show before in the past, the NSA does not need any Patriot Act laws to grab data from the tech services that you do. You've already given consent under executive order 12333.
Right, and we discussed that.
They can suck up all your data from these tech services as much as they want.
Yeah.
Without any further permission from you. So, you know, it's a concern. I'm not sure whether it's something I'm going to lose sleep over at this point in time, but it is something that I think is, you know, an element to keep in the back of your mind. Like if you're trying to make a practice of not being followed by, you know, whoever, marketers or government, then I'm not sure exactly why you'd have Facebook on your phone anyway to begin with. But if you did, this is probably a service that you don't want to allow Facebook to use on your phone if you're concerned about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I mean, that's a very good point. I don't think, I always a little sketchy about the whole Shazam thing or any, you know, Google had a technology like this that they were promoting a year or so ago where they'll be listening in on just everything that's going on. You know, the microphone's automatically on and it's automatically listening and ingesting all this stuff. And
Microsoft had the same thing with the X-Bone as well, didn't they? You know, there was a big controversy about that. Yeah,
It's basically the same technology that allows you to activate Google services by saying, "Okay, Google, it's always listening."
Yeah exactly. And see that now this is the concern is not necessarily that your standard Google employee is going to, sell your information to, whatever, or sell conversations that you have to whatever, you know, but there is the potential for abuse. That's the concern I think that people have, and that extends to the issues related to the NSA as well. When a lot of people use the argument of I've got nothing to be concerned about, I've got nothing to hide and stuff like that. Okay, that's fine. Not really, but if you look at the bigger picture, if you're someone that's up and coming in a certain industry,
mm-hmm.
and your competitor in Google or Microsoft or the NSA or whatever finds some data on you that's a little bit compromising, they can use that to blackmail you and get you out of the way. So it's leverage, essentially, is what I think would be the concern.
Yeah.
I think it's an inappropriate use of resources, but what are you going to do?
You always bring the tin hat when you come to the show.
I have to. And I mean, I'm not as bad as what some people are. I mean, you've heard some conspiracy theorists out there. I try to stay on the fence and go, let's look at both sides of the story here. And for some people, it is a real concern.
Sure, sure.
And I acknowledge that. I mean, it's not a huge concern for me. But I think it's important information that I think people should be at least aware about, particularly if they're going to be using these products, that a lot of the data that they suck in about you is going to be used against you in some way, whether that be for nefarious purposes or for marketing purposes.
Right, right, right. And we need people to act as watchdogs, even if the fears are unfounded. I think it's important to at least address the fears.
Yeah, I agree. I think it comes down to potential abuse. I think highlighting potential abuse is something that people need to be aware about. And there's nothing. I mean, I'm not saying the sky is falling or anything here, but I'm just saying that I think this is relevant information that Facebook users probably want to know about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no segue into this, but speaking
but we did talk about Google, so yeah.
Okay. let's move the cannon away from Facebook and onto Google. So in Google News, Google is developing a new cutting edge tablet about to produce about 4,000 prototype tablets. That will come with a 7-inch screen and be equipped with two back cameras, infrared depth sensors, and advanced software that can capture precise three-dimensional images of objects. the tablet's being developed as part of a Google research effort dubbed Project Tango. And we talked about Project Tango on the Drill Down a few episodes ago.
That sounds like a military term, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. doesn't it?
Skynet, everyone.
yeah, the division that Google is running this out of also sounds like something out of the military.
Yeah.
Their Advanced Technology and Projects Group.
Yeah.
So Project Tango is designed to create a 3D map of the user's surroundings, and the technology demonstrated in the smartphone that they had before could be used to improve indoor navigation for the visually impaired or step-by-step directions within stores, as well as immersive video games. So they've got these supposedly they've got these new tablets that will be Tango equipped.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I hear this stuff and, we, you know, two back cameras, you know, infrared depth sensors and stuff like that. And I'm not going to go down the tinfoil.
I'm going to go
down the sci-fi route. Uh-huh, you might be surprised. But there was a television show that came out of England a few years ago that it was actually you that turned me on to this, Andy, called Black Mirror.
Oh,
and there was one particular episode in there where there was a device that was basically plugged into your head. And it would record all of your memories, and you could replay your memories in your mind with this device in kind of like a quasi virtual reality zone. And you could replay the things that you saw and experienced and other things that were around at the time. But the key element that was in that plot was that it also picked up things that you weren't looking at directly. So, you know, there's obviously some kind of 3D sensor thing running with this particular device in the sci-fi thing. This tablet and the Project Tango stuff reminds me or it makes me think of that we're taking very little baby steps towards that kind of technology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this pleases me or worries me, but it's fascinating to me because I think we're entering a zone in technology now that is just unimaginable.
Yes.
I really do think that. I mean, there's a lot of talk of robotics at the moment, and this is the kind of technology that you would expect to be implemented with robotics as well, you know, particularly with sensory devices. So I think we're on a track here that is I just get the feeling that we're stepping into an unprecedented level of technological advances, and this is just the beginning of it.
Yeah. Every week there's one or two new advances that brings us a little closer to the future that we envisioned when we were kids or when we think about the future. And in fact, we've got a couple of more of those news items on this episode that were announced this week. But before we get into that, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com. The world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And appropriately enough for what we've been talking about, the book I want to talk about is called Age of Context, Mobile Sensors, Data, and the Future of Privacy.
Oh, incredibly
relevant. Yeah, yes. By Robert Scoble and Shel Israel. Now, the premise of this is that our devices know when to wake us up early because it snowed last night. They contact the people we're supposed to meet to warn them we're running late. They even find content worth watching on television. They also promise to cure cancer and make it harder for terrorists to do their damage. Astoundingly, in the coming age, you may only receive ads you want to see. What does it all mean? How will this change society in the future? Robert Scoble and Shel Israel are unabashed tech enthusiasts. But as they write, an elephant sits in the living room of our book, and it's called privacy. We're entering a time when our technology serves us best because it watches us, collecting data on what we do, who we speak with, what we look at. There's no doubt about it, big data is watching you. The time to lament the loss of privacy is over. Our authors argue that the time is right to demand options that enable people to reclaim some portions of that privacy. So incredibly, prescient and incredibly appropriate for the discussion that we were just having about Facebook. And
extremely relevant for this episode, I must say. It really is. And it does make you wonder. I mean, because there's two sides to this story. And one of them, of course, is, you know, what we've alluded to, you know, earlier on with the concerns about privacy right out there to the tinfoil hat conspiracy theories. But then the other argument is, do we really need to worry too much about this? I mean, that's the other counter argument. I mean, this technology is basically being designed and developed to improve convenience and assist our everyday lives. So, you know, where do you stand on that spectrum, and how much do you need to be aware about? How much do you need to be worried, if at all?
I also think that if everyone is aware of it, and everyone, and we do have a number of people who are acting as watchdogs, that it could never get too out of our control, because we do have people who are serving as the public watchdog.
Forewarned is forearmed. I mean, education is everything, really, when it comes down to it. I mean, the more you're informed, the better equipped you are to make decisions about your life. And I think that comes down to technology as well. We've even had, it's recent history, but in terms of the internet, you might as well say it's ancient history, but we've had examples of that with internet use as well, like in terms of how much information you disclose about yourself on the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, that's another example. We're looking at the next age of context, if you take the title.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a significant question.
Yeah.
And, I agree with you. I think watchdogs and being aware of what's out there, I think being able to educate people and let them know what this stuff is actually doing, in addition to its conveniences, does nothing to hurt the experience, I don't think.
Right. I mean, I think it all starts with if we're aware of it, then we can control how much privacy we allow other people to intrude on, allow other people to have. You know, we control our own privacy. We control what we put up on the internet, ultimately.
Yeah exactly.
In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And remember, using that URL helps us out on the show. So please, if you're not an Audible subscriber, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep the book for free. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Amazon plays dirty with publishers and how it'll affect you. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Paperback writer.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Greg Davies of the Blendover podcast.
That's me.
Amazon has been castigated in recent weeks for employing questionable tactics and irresponsibly wielding its tremendous influence as it looks to strike a new ebook deal with book publisher Hachette. Many books from the publisher are experiencing long shipping delays, often between 2 and 3 weeks, Even when Hachette insists that it's fulfilling Amazon's every order in a timely manner, and the pre-order button has disappeared for some upcoming Hachette titles, including J.K. Rowling's the latest novel, Amazon is noticeably cutting back on discounts as well, putting Hachette's books much closer to their full list price. And in some instances, the company's been using banner ads to highlight, quote, similar items at a lower price, a move that has incensed writers caught in the middle of a discord they have no control over. And most recently, Amazon has halted paperback sales of Brad Stone's The Everything Store, a book that Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon's wife, has attacked as lopsided and misleading. There's been no explanation for the change, except for the fact that The Everything Store is published by Back Bay Books, which is an imprint of Hachette.
The plot thickens.
Yeah,
this sounds dirty.
Absolutely.
This sounds like dirty leverage, if you will. It's like, you know, Amazon are pretty powerful now. And, you know, they can, they have a bit of control over leverage in terms of, even if you're an independent publisher and you're doing your own book,
yeah,
your own little book, ebook to put on Amazon, which you can do in this day and age, you know, you're at the mercy of Amazon. You really are.
Right. They're the, you know, the 800-pound gorilla. And they've effectively stomped out some of the other competition, including many brick and mortar stores, such as Borders and Walden Books. You know, mm-hmm. Amazon's been directly responsible because of their great service and their great prices, their ability to undercut the competition. And now it seems like they're abusing that. In fact, Amazon recently had a note on one of their forums that says that in reference to this feud with Hachette, they said that a retailer can feature a supplier's items in its advertising and promotional circulars, stack it high in front of the store, keep small quantities on hand in the back aisle, or not carry the item at all. And bookstores and other retailers do this every day. And then they go on to even recommend that buyers look for Hachette books amongst its third-party sellers or even buy them from one of Amazon's competitors. Amazon is recommending to consumers that they buy Hachette books from their competitors. That's how dug in they are at this.
This is dirty. This is just. You know, I think it does stem from like the implication in the articles is that Jeff Bezos' wife was pissed off about a particular book, and he's put his foot down and said, "Right, we're gonna put the nails in." That's what it smells of.
I want to read a quote from Farhad Manju of New York Times, he's an excellent journalist. And he has an interesting take on this. He says, for years, authors and publishers have warned that Amazon, Jeff Bezos' bookselling giant, would one day use its power for ill. Sure, so far, Amazon has marketed itself as a book buyer's best friend. It sells books at terrifically low prices, delivers them amazingly quickly, and constantly invents new technologies to improve the way we read. And we've seen that with the Kindle. Mm-hmm. Amazon has also heavily invested in publishing new authors and pushed exciting new formats made possible by electric distribution. Yet the literary community has always greeted Amazon's moves with suspicion. The fear is mostly about the future. What will happen to books when Amazon controls the entire industry? How will authors and publishing houses reckon with Amazon's unchecked power?
Here we go. This is an undercurrent theme of the entire episode, the potential for abuse.
The potential for abuse. Just wait, Farhad Manju says. The company's critics have always shot back. Wait till Amazon controls the whole market. Then see how well it treats authors, publishers, and consumers. Now Amazon is walking right into its detractors' predictions. There's a couple obvious reasons this is a bad strategy. It's bad public relations. If it doesn't already, Amazon may soon control a monopolistic stake of the ebook market, and its tactics are sure to invite not only scorn from the book industry, but also increase regulatory oversight.
Soon control?
Yes. Well,
I think they already control it. Borderline monopoly right now.
It really is.
You know, where else do you get ebooks from now in this day and age? I mean, you know, we're talking about
Kindle.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about your sponsor earlier, Audible. That's audiobooks.
That's right. Audible is a full disclosure here. Audible is a Amazon company.
Right. But that's audiobooks, but with ebooks, where are you going? Well, you go to Amazon. Where else are you going to go?
Yeah.
You know, that's where I've always gone to get my ebooks.
Right. No, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because Audible is an Amazon company, and I would say that, like, I'm an Audible subscriber myself, and I would say that 90% of the books that I purchased from Audible are come from Hachette.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. So my question is, how is this going to affect my Audible purchases?
Well, I don't think this is going to be a long-term thing. I mean, this is just a...
It's a feud.
This is a feud, and it's going to blow over. Yeah. As to how long it lasts is another question altogether. But I mean, once it is over and done with, I think everything will return to normal. I think obviously there's something that perhaps that Bezos and Amazon wants from Hachette. I'm not exactly sure what that might be, or this could be just punishment. For the
everything
quote
store.
About his wife being pissed off about that book, you know. But I think the key thing here is that there's a very it's very prescient in my mind anyway. But I mean, there's a very clear difference between a bookseller and a librarian. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, the bookseller is going to have other interests, as in profit,
and
the leverage of power. Whereas a librarian is kind of like open for, the all information to be out there. So it's a big question. And I think one of the things that Amazon has popularized over the last 10 years has been the purchasing of books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has. I mean, it's popularized the purchasing of books, the ease of purchasing of books. You kind of alluded to the closure of many bookstores because of it, and that is a fact. But I think the other impact is that it's kind of taken away the concept of loaning books from a library. And I know they do have a loan scheme for ebooks on Amazon.com, but it strikes me that as odd that we don't have a standalone electronic library. We kind of do with Google, some of the Google books that are out there that are open, but there's nothing out there like a like an electronic library,
like a Library of Alexandria, but for the modern age.
Right, where you don't keep the book, you don't keep it. You've got it for a certain time on your reader or in your tablet or whatever, and away it goes. Maybe that's a startup somebody should start looking into.
I know that some local libraries have services like that.
Right, but it's a local level. I mean,
I think what we
need on the international level, because really, that's what the internet's all about now. It's not about your local level. It's about making the international level local to you. And I think obviously what this indicates to me is that Amazon has kind of. Run its course in the sense that it'll still be out there and you can still buy your books. But I think what we need is an impartial service. The Library of Congress could start doing this. But, you know, a lot of these tech advances usually come from private industry. So I don't know. I'm just kind of rambling at this point, but you kind of get where I'm coming from. We've kind of lost the joy of the library, if you will, and the ability to borrow books and soak up as much information as you can. I can't remember the last time I borrowed a book from the library.
Yeah, like I almost, and that's another thing, is that I fear that almost the advent of the technology of digital distribution of books may have put an end to the need for a physical lending library.
No, I disagree. I think the concept of a library is you get a membership, you go there, you pick a book off the shelf, and you walk out with it, you read it, and then you put it back.
Okay. Now,
the same thing with in a digital circumstance, you may have to pay a membership fee or kind for that kind of service, but the premise is the same. You can get any electronic book you want at any time, read it, and then return it. I mean, essentially, when you think about it, the more I'm thinking about it now, we should be doing this, Andy. You and I, we should start this up. We'd be sitting on a gold mine. But, you know...
Well, it's all about the licensing, too. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that in order to do that, you have to get the licenses for the books.
That's true.
And
but
they're all tied up with the booksellers.
This is what I'm thinking, though. Essentially, what I'm thinking is the equivalent of a Pandora or a Google Music or a Netflix, but in book format.
Well, that's Oyster, is what you're describing.
Oyster, yeah. Actually, you know what? I got an invite to them, and I really should check them out. I think I think they're on a winner if they're going to be doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is another zone I think we need to keep a look into, because if this is one of many steps in the douchebaggery of Amazon, then, you know, we might need to look at alternatives. Let me bring up something else.
Before you move on to that, let me just one more quote here, and this will segue right into what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. I want to read one more quote from Mr. Manju, New York Times. He says that the more basic problem here is that Amazon is violating its own code. To win a corporate battle, Amazon is ruining its customer experience. Mr. Bezos has long pointed to customer satisfaction as his North Star. Making sure customers are treated well is the guiding principle for how he runs Amazon. And in that, if you think about that, books are just scratching the surface of what Amazon does now. And Amazon has expanded itself to selling just about everything, to being a market for just about everything. And people are utilizing that more and more. And as such,
you can get sex toys on there now. You can get fucking pipes for your pot, you know?
But the question is, can we expect to be the victims of caught in the crossfire of feuds like this the other products that Amazon sells? I mean, are we now sort of trapped under the thumb of Amazon's whims as far as its, you know, its control of the marketplace, now that we're kind of locked into their services?
Yes.
This is the short. Yeah.
We are. That's the short answer. But we are, because essentially, I argue with the New York Times author there in the sense that it's soon to be a monopoly. I think it already is. I think it already controls the lion's share of electronic book distribution, and I think it just further justifies my argument that services like Oyster, as an example, need to expand and grow, and we need to give them more attention. I think in terms of you know, a library-based rental service, if you will, or any other additional services out there where you can get ebooks from. I mean, I can't think of any other ebook services off the top of my head. I can think of a few comic book-based ones, but not novels. You know, and especially with, you got Barnes and Noble. They've got the Nook, right? That's what they've got out there.
Yeah.
And so, but see, that's the thing.
Discontinued the Nook too.
Did they? Oh, okay. Yeah. But that's the thing. So they've got this, Amazon have got this proprietary Kindle thing going on. You know, we need more freedom in reading, I think. And,
the bottom line is, when you put the leash on the 800-pound gorilla, you don't really lead it. It leads you.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the thing about Amazon, and I got to be honest, because I actually like Amazon a lot, and it really pains me to talk about them in such a negative light, because I've always had extremely wonderful experiences with them, even on the customer service level when something's gone wrong with an order.
Yes.
They have been absolutely superb. Honestly, I would sing them to the heavens. But this is just...
it's disappointing.
It is extremely disappointing, but it reminds me of a saying that a mentor of mine once said to me when I was about 13 years old, and that was, he said, it takes a lifetime to build up a good reputation, but it takes 1 second to ruin it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think if this drags out any further than what it is now,
yep,
this is going to be the ruination of the reputation for Amazon, and it's going to chime the need for additional services out there like Oyster.
Sure, sure, absolutely, absolutely.
So douchebaggery, can I jump in?
Absolutely,
this?
Yeah.
This is just a side note in relation to Amazon, because I saw this pop up on my feed earlier today. I think it stems back to March, actually, because some people were aware about this back in March, but it's only really just in the last couple of days that it's grabbed the attention of a lot of people, notably some bloggers and Stephen Colbert. But the U.S. Patent Office recently awarded a photography patent to Amazon, and it's simply titled Studio Arrangement. And it explains exactly where to place lightning camera position and the subject in order to shoot photos against a white backdrop in order to create a slight reflection near the bottom of a near-perfect seamless backdrop. Now, to translate that, what that actually means is a photograph of any one individual person or objects in front of a white background. How many photos out there have you seen on the internet, in the world, of an individual or an item on a white background? I mean, that's like 90% of your stock photography out there, you know.
Virtually everything on eBay.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, this is, this came to my attention this morning. I got one of those spam messages about, you know, sign our petition, we're against Amazon on this. And, you know, it grabbed my attention immediately, because this is total patent abuse. I mean, really, I mean, this is beyond patent trolls. Patent abuse. It's like, you know, it's kind of like that rumor about Gene Simmons trademarking the phrase OJ, as in OJ for orange juice. That's just stupid.
Well, you know, this is just an indictment of what is inherently wrong with the patent system.
Yeah.
In general, which is that it's too general. People don't there isn't enough oversight over the patents. Patents are granted without understanding how general they are, that, you know, that now you've just granted the patent to photos in front of a white background, which opens up for lawsuits. There needs to be massive patent reform. We've talked about this many times on the show.
Yeah, I do want to add the disclaimer, like, this is just surface content that we're talking about here. I haven't had the time to dig in deep and look into the actual patent documentation, because you know what a lot of the tech media is like, folks. They like to grab causes and go with them, and sometimes without disclosing a lot of information that's in the original documents as well. This has happened many times before. And so, you know, I just want to kind of add that, you know, little cherry there and just say, look, you know, there might be more to this than meets the eye.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I haven't read the original documentation. I'm just going by the news articles that I've seen so far. But it does make for an interesting topic to talk about, and it just heaps onto the terrible reputation that Amazon's starting to build for itself.
Yep, yep.
Very sad.
Additional douchebaggery.
Yes. that should be the title of your show, additional douchebaggery.
We spoke briefly about the Code Conference that's going on this week. In reference to the announcement that Apple was purchasing Beats, we've got a couple more announcements from the Code Conference. First of which is that Microsoft head of Skype and Link, both Skype and Link, Gurdeep Singh Pal, showed off a new speech-to-speech translation technology that the company is looking to introduce in future versions of its Skype products. The feature, which Skype is hoping to roll out in beta later this year, translates speech from one language to another in near real time. As it was demoed, the feature translated Paul's speech from English into text for transcription on a colleague's screen in German, and also into voice in German, and vice versa.
Well, now, this is fascinating because I think it was last year or the year before, Microsoft introduced it was like some personal assistant language technology that was going to be in Windows 8.1. And basically what it was like, you know, you could record a video of somebody talking in Swahili, and then when you play it back, it'll auto-translate in, you know, with subtitles for you and stuff like that. And I saw a demonstration of it, and it actually looked pretty impressive. So if they're doing real-time stuff now...
Real-time.
That's fantastic.
Yes. It's amazing. It's just like that... It's you know, the dream of real-time universal translation has been the stuff of science fiction for decades.
Yeah.
And it's like we talked about earlier in this episode that we're seeing all of these new technologies make science fiction science fact. And it's just amazing to see.
This is something straight out of Doctor Who and Star Trek.
Yep.
Yes. You know, this is fantastic. I do want to add, though, I mean, apparently, and I only heard this the other day, but apparently the Google Translate app for Android, I'm not sure if it's on iPhone or not, but apparently that's really good for people going overseas to different countries. It does a similar thing where you can type or speak into the phone and say, like if you're in China or something like that, and say, hey, I need to go to Tiananmen Square, it will translate it in various dialects for that region so that you can show the cab driver or whatever where you want to go.
Yeah.
It's almost real-time translation, but this is really good. This is a great idea for Skype. It makes me wonder how else you could use this kind of technology. The television would be fantastic.
Oh, sure. Oh, my goodness. To be watching a foreign TV show and have it automatically translate.
Yeah.
And translate both in text or in dialogue. Have this, you know, artificial voice speak the text.
Could you imagine, like, breaking news coming out of, like, a place like the Netherlands or something like that? Like, I'm talking massive news, like something on a 9/11 scale or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming from the Netherlands or Europe or, you know, a country where the native language is not English. And if you had this kind of tech built into your computer or your phone or your television, you could stream whatever that live report is, and it would just auto-translate for you with subtitles on the fly. I mean, that would be superb.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I
cannot. And just alone, the fact that this is being incorporated into Skype, which people already use for international calls.
You know what's really interesting about this to me is, like, what else this technology is going to be used for. Is going to put, like, United Nations translators out of business.
Yeah.
You know, this technology could be adjusted for that kind of stuff and adapted for that. I mean, it would be perfect for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there is something still to be said about nuances of translation.
Yes.
I don't know how nuanced the automatic translation is. I'm sure it's enough to get by. Like, you can muddle through the translation and sort of do a little transliteration yourself, even if it's sort of a rough translation. And that's something that I think would a professional translator would still have the edge over. But who knows? It's only a matter of time before even nuances like that get translated accurately.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take one last break. And when we come back, our drill down video of the week gets behind the wheel. So call Shotgun, take a listen to this, and come on back.
Shotgun. Ask the girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I want to be famous, a star on the screen. But you can do something in between. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Thank you.
You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sorcini. I'm here with Greg Davies of the Blendover podcast.
Word.
So Google, who has been testing self-driving cars, modified cars with their self-driving technology for years now, has finally built its own car from scratch. And they showed it off at the Code conference in Rancho Palos Verdes, California. It looks like a gondola with wheels. The two-seater prototype vehicle is Google's reimagination of what the modern automobile should look and feel like if you took the human out of the transportation equation and designed something solely to chauffeur passengers from point A to point B. Google co-founder Sergey Brin said the project is about changing the world for people who are not well served by transportation today. There's not great public transportation in many areas, public places in the United States. The car, which was conceived and designed by Google, unlike the ones that is previously modified, lacks many of the trappings of a normal car, and that includes the three essentials: a steering wheel, accelerator, and brake pedal. Unlike the prototype vehicles tested over the last year, which are carefully monitored by Google employees who are ready to take control at any moment, this new car is entirely driven by computers. Because of the compact round frame of the prototype with built-in sensor mounts, Google says the car has virtually no blind spots. It also has newer and better sensors that give it the ability to see what's going on up to a distance of 2 football fields. It's got for example, on the most current version of the retrofitted cars, a mounted laser has about a 12-degree field of view that it uses to essentially zoom in on details and points of interest. On the prototype car, the lasers have a full 360-degree views. The prototype car is closer to what Google wants to see sold on the market, but they say that they have no plans to sell the cars themselves, but they're looking for partners to make it happen.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. There are laws in California currently that require a test driver to be in a vehicle and be able to take over the controls in the event of an accident. But Google's expecting a follow-up regulation later this year that will allow manufacturers to apply for permits to operate fully autonomous vehicles.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I often err on the side of caution, and like I've done earlier in the show, like, you know, head along the tinfoil hat area kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything better than this. I think this is brilliant. The tests that they've done on the previous vehicles that they've modified, I can't remember the numbers, but like there's been no.
I think 3 accidents, but they were all because of human intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Like humans jumped in and took over the wheel, and then the accidents.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Yeah. And part of the reason I think this is fantastic is because if this technology takes off and it starts to propagate across the country and the world, it will inflict serious damage on that racket known as the insurance industry.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
I'm all about that.
Yep. Now, that's going to be a huge hurdle right there, because how what do you think the odds are that the insurance company is going to give up easily and allow driverless vehicles to be on the road without any sort of...
Well, I think your first hurdle is going to be municipalities more than anything else. Not so much whether they're going to make it legal or not for these cars to be on the road, but more along the lines of whether they're going to allow you to beam this vehicle without it having any insurance or something along those lines. I don't know, the concept... You know, I don't know. See, I could be mistaken here, but thinking about the way it's going to eventually propagate, it would be a slow propagation. So you would probably need insurance because of the other drivers on the road and other humans' errors.
Yeah.
You know, it may come up that way. But eventually, I'm thinking more along the lines of like 25 to 50 years down the road, when these cars, you know, replace everything, is there going to be a need for insurance? I don't think there will be.
Yeah, I'm really glad that Google is going like that where they intend to head this for first and foremost is public transportation. I love that because that's first of all it really does. There really is a need for that, and a driverless vehicle is a natural fulfillment of that need.
Can I just say as well, for the listeners, if you haven't seen the video of the actual car in action mm-hmm. yet, you really should take a look at it because the photos of this vehicle don't do it any justice. The shape of the car, the way it's shaped, it's a two-door vehicle with two seats. There's no back seat in it. When you look at it, it looks tiny. It looks really tiny. Yeah. But when you look at the video of the people actually getting into the vehicle, there looks to be plenty of room in that.
Sure.
It looks larger than what it actually is. Have a look at the video. I think this is fantastic. I can't do anything but sing praises of this. I mean, I have visions of footage of Jean-Claude Van Damme in Time Cop going home at the end of the day from the time agency and he's automatically driving car.
Once again, the visions of the future from science fiction come true.
Visions of the future. That's another potential title there. Write that one down. So I think this is great.
I love this video too because you're right. It does. It looks like a smart car, perhaps, is the closest sort of analogy to an actual car in the road. Except it's roomy because there's no console. There's no drive. There's no steering wheel. No none of the stuff that's usually in front of a driver. It's all empty. So it's all like space to relax.
Yeah, you can just sit there and actually text people on your phone while you're driving.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, the one time when it's okay to text and drive.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I think this is great. I think this is wonderful. Yeah. I love this concept. And, but, the work that they've done on this so far, the numbers speak for themselves, I think. Yeah. And I think they're heading in a direction. But, I'd be really curious as to see where this goes from here. I mean, they're saying at the moment that they want it to head towards the towards partnerships for public transportation and whatnot, but I can see that eventually some people are going to be looking at the potential of owning one of these things themselves.
Yes, see, and you're exactly right. I think you hit upon something that this is potentially transformative because once we moved from public transportation to private ownership of these vehicles. The indicated use, the way you're supposed to use it is to be a passenger, then you're right. Then the insurance thing is going to be we're completely going to upend the current insurance situation in the country right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so, too. You know, or it's going to shift it anyway. I mean, I think if the insurance companies want to get a leg up in this industry, they would probably want to, from a marketable point of view, reduce cost of insurance if you're owning one of these vehicles, based upon the safety recommendations or the safety numbers of this particular thing. So I like the idea of I like the concept. I love it. I think this has major potential, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. I mean, this is science fiction becoming reality yet again. It's one of those things. This has really been a utopia versus dystopia show, hasn't it? Really, when you think about it, we're talking about the benefits versus the potential abuses of technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that really is that. I think that really is. You've hit upon the theme of the show.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's kind of where we're going with this. But I think this is wonderful. This is really, really wonderful news to see. In the video though, I'm not sure if that guy that gets in at the end is actually blind or not. He probably isn't. I hate to say it, but he probably
think he's lying about his blindness.
I don't know. I'm just saying for the purposes of PR, they could have got any actors in.
Sure,
but that being said, that does highlight a very important part of this particular self-driving car technology is that it opens up so much accessibility for people with disabilities, whether it be blindness or, a walking disability of some kind. I mean, this just revolutionizes mobility for so many people. And the quicker we get this out into reality and out of prototype, the better it's going to be for humanity in the long run, I think. Now all we need is, one of these things with a flux capacitor in it, and we're golden.
Well, that'll be next week's show is when we announce the flux capacitor.
We'll travel forward in time to the year 2015. Oh, wait, that's only next year.
Right.
Doesn't that make you feel old?
Oh, my God.
We're going to have to do, like, I don't know. This is just an off-the-cuff suggestion here. But I think that the Drill Down and Blendover should do something next year to celebrate Back to the Future. I mean, it's going to be the 30th anniversary of the movie anyway.
Sure.
But that's the year in the story that Marty McFly travels to.
Yeah.
It should do some kind of crossover or something like that to celebrate it. I think it'd be fun.
Yeah. I mean, I could definitely see sort of what was predicted back then and what has come to pass now and what has yet to come to pass. Like, what has yet to, what do we have left to predict? We still need to have the 3D holographic version of Jaws.
That's true, but we have better 3D movies now.
Yes.
Just to touch on that. I mean, so anyway, that was just a random thought. But Google are on the money with this one. I think that this is a fantastic development that they're doing. And, I mean, could you imagine if they release it to the marketplace as a private purchase? I mean, what it would have in there? I mean, you could plug your Android phone in there and have the speakers so that you play your music on the way to work. And, you know, you could probably have a heads-up display on the windshield. And, man, I mean, this is brilliant. This is fantastic. This is the science fiction utopia you and I have dreamed of for years, you know, when we were kids.
Yep.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Now that Google has designed this, created it, shown, basically shown it in an actual physical world manifestation, someone is going to jump on this. If it's not one of the big car manufacturers, it's going to be someone like Tesla.
Oh, the Tesla would have to be the next on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
If they don't partner with Google, I mean, that's an entire possibility right there. Yeah. I mean, I could imagine either situation happening, Tesla competing with Google or partnering with them on this. In fact, come to think of it, I mean, I think in the long run, I mean, considering that the majority of vehicles out there are still gasoline driven in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the vehicles in the market, they have the lion's share of vehicles that are sold versus electric cars. That would probably be their best bet, to have not necessarily a merger, but a partnership of some kind to develop this for private industry. It would give them a little bit more power and leverage against the larger competition that they've got.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And also create a great sort of, for Tesla, it would create a great lower end of the market for people to buy into, so that to cover the other side of their high end of the market.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That is assuming that something like this would be low cost. The self-driving technology has got to be fairly expensive, I would imagine.
Well, there's that. I mean, I would imagine that there is a certain expense associated with it. But, I mean, if you go by the trend set by both car manufacturing and technology, usually the first issue of certain technologies are generally more expensive than the follow-up models.
Yeah.
And not only that, but as they age as well, they reduce in price as well. So I imagine that it'll have that kind of like initial iPad effect where it was like super expensive, but then prices dropped eventually. And it's the same with a lot of this technology when it comes out for the first time. I think the best example that the comparable example that we can say right now is 4K and 8K television. The cost is rather expensive right now, but eventually, like we saw with HD TV and flat screen televisions, once they started propagating a little bit more, especially with a little bit more competition out there, the prices dropped significantly. And a lot of that has to do with them overcoming their the initial overhead, but also, they want to capture that early adopter market, which is usually people that have, quite a bit of dosh to throw at toys like this.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for our show, with the exception of asking you, Greg, where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here helping us out on the Drill Down?
You can catch me at blendover.com. And blendover.com/live when we do the show live on Monday nights and Friday nights, 8:30 p.m. Central Time. And, of course, Blendover is the podcast that brings you the news that the news isn't covering. And I just want to throw out there that this time next week, Friday night, for the live show, the host of this show, Andy Cercini, is going to be joining me on the show. And we're actually going to be having a bit of a preview for E3, I think, right? We're going to talk about what you're looking forward to.
Yes.
Because you're heading to E3, right?
I'm heading to E3. I'll be going there the week after that I'm on your show. And I don't know. I'm going there for my own sort of edification, but I'll be, of course, talking about what I've seen there on the Drill Down. And I'll be talking about what I'm looking forward to checking out on a Blendover podcast.
Absolutely. I can't wait. I like this little kind of bleed over between our shows.
Yeah.
It's really cool. It's a nice kind of flow. But anyway, folks, if you're interested, blendover.com is where you can catch me for the podcast. Go ahead and bookmark it or look us up in iTunes.
Absolutely. It's a great show. Great place to get the news that is not trending.
That's right.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or do a Google search for Mr. Babyman. That's my social media handle, and you'll find all my work there. As far as the show goes, if you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful and faithful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And, of course, be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Dilly-gaff.